Hello and welcome to episode 43 of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And in this, the 43rd episode, I'm talking to James Rolfe, who's Chief Operating Officer at Anglia Ruskin University. James joined Anglia Ruskin some 4 years ago after an unusual career journey, which began in the civil service in Whitehall in the 90s, before leading him to a role in social services in Norfolk, and then as a senior manager at Enfield Council. We explore some of the differences and similarities with higher education, with James arguing that really the culture and operations in central and local government are not really that different. Rather, it is a bit like adjusting the sliders on a graphic equaliser. ARU operates across three main campuses in Chelmsford, Cambridge and most recently Peterborough. We explore the practicalities of this. Together we're looking more closely at the terrific new development in the traditional higher education cold spot of Peterborough, where there remain real ambitions for growth in partnership with the local authorities. James and I then discuss, given that this was recorded in confirmation and clearing week, the particular challenges faced by the latest generation of new students and the need for universities to offer enhanced support to this group, both in terms of orientation but throughout their studies, to ensure that they have every opportunity to succeed. Finally, we look at the wider issues of regulation, competition and collaboration among universities and the great opportunities provided and the work done by AHUA, an organisation of which we are both proud to be members. I do hope you enjoy it. Right, well, welcome everyone to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time it's my huge pleasure to introduce James Rolfe. James is Chief Operating Officer at Anglia Ruskin University. James, great welcome to you. Thank you ever so much for taking the time to talk. First off, it would be, well, tell us a bit about you, because I can't recall, you've been at Anglia Ruskin a few years, but you've had a very unusual career route, I think, into being a university COO. So how did you end up there?
Yeah, thanks, Paul, and thanks for inviting me along. I guess my career is in sort of three phases, really. So the first phase was in the civil service, and I really enjoyed my time in the civil service. I worked in Whitehall during the 1990s, so got involved in all sorts of things. You know, the most fascinating being the move from the major government through to the Blair government, but things like PFI, things like the demise of the Warsaw Pact, and the introduction of sort of democratic governance in the former Warsaw Pact countries, things like major financial management reform, because in the 1990s there was an awful lot of that going on, following on from, you know, Michael Heseltine's financial management initiative in the late 1980s and Margaret Thatcher's Rayner reviews and all of that sort of thing. So, yeah, my first 15 years were in Whitehall or in central government. But towards the end of my time in Whitehall, and I was sort of getting to 32, 33, something like that, I wanted to do sort of more tangible stuff. I didn't really want to go and be a policy person in Whitehall. So the opportunity to work in social services, as it then was, up in Norfolk came along. I'm from that part of the world. I really like Norfolk, still do. And I was sort of fascinated by social services. So I went and worked in social services in Norfolk for 4 years. And, you know, I was originally driven by the desire to get involved in children's social services. You know, they deal with some absolutely the most complex problems in society. And I wanted to get involved in some of that and do something about it. But I actually found that working with people with learning difficulties and working with older people, I actually found more rewarding. So that was an interesting, you know, lesson learning about myself. So I was hungry for promotion and then went and was an executive director of resources in London for about 11 years, actually. So I was the statutory finance officer, covered all governance issues, registrars, customer services, IT, transformation, works, leisure arts, culture, revenues, benefits, all sorts of other things. So an amazing variety of things down in London. Great time.
So is that in a local authority then?
Yeah, that was in the local authority. Yeah, that was Enfield Council, one of the London boroughs right up at the north of London. And then towards the end of my time there, I sort of reached a milestone birthday. I thought, oh, what do I want to do in the final phase of my career? Yeah. So I'd known Anglia Ruskin for a long time. You know, it's fairly close to where I'd grown up, sort of had that indirect association with it for quite a while, fascinated by the widening participation agenda, giving the opportunities to, you know, people from all walks of life. And by very good coincidence, the COO job came up. So I obviously had the skills and the knowledge and the background. It was really much more around organisational fit and the cultural differences between HE and local government, and indeed the civil service. Went for the job, got it, and I've been here 4 years and really enjoying it.
Fantastic. So, well, let's talk a little bit about that, the differences then between the civil service and local government and universities, because, I mean, you know, you're not unique in the sense that people do come from outside the sector into it. But I mean, in my experience, people either, you know, thrive or really struggle, right? You're clearly thriving. You've been there for 4 years. You're enjoying it. But I mean, what were those differences that you really noticed when you came in?
Sure. So, I mean, I suppose I'd equate it to one of those 1980s graphic equalizers. You know, they're all the same switches in the left and the right channel, or indeed in local government and HE, but they're sometimes at different settings. So employee relations, for example, is a bigger is a bigger issue in HE than it was in the local authorities that I worked in. There's also some interesting cultural differences. You know, there's always this discussion about, you know, professional services and academics working together. But that's not unlike my experience of working with the armed forces, you know, where civil servants worked hand in hand with the armed forces. Very different roles, very different responsibilities, sometimes very, very different perspectives on military power, you know. But we always found a way of working together to deliver the outcomes that we wanted to achieve. And that's really what, you know, that's the approach I take here at AIU as well, very often coming from completely different perspectives than my academic colleagues, but we're all in it for the same thing, and that is the student, the widening participation agenda, all of that good stuff. And I think the other thing, in terms of sort of the culture, how does it feel instinctively, how does it feel? It feels more like the civil service than it does local government, because if you did a legal comparison, I'm sure it would be more like local government than the civil service. But in terms of how it feels, it actually feels very much like Whitehall, a lot of very clever people thinking about a lot of important issues. But with the added benefit here in university land is that we actually deliver the end product as well, whereas in Whitehall, you tend not to. You tend to issue policy and guidance and money out to other agencies.
Yeah. Oh no, that's really fascinating. And for those who didn't get the graphic equalizer reference, I'm sure they can look it up. Younger members of the of the audience. So Anglia Ruskin, I mean, as you say, it's got a strong widening participation ethos, has, I think, since its foundation. But it's also got this, you know, odd. Well, I say odd. It's a distinctive physical structure with main sites in Chelmsford and Cambridge, and it is also historically, there have been mergers down the way, haven't they, in its history. So how does that play out in practice? Is it a challenge, is it an obstacle, or is it just the way the place is?
It's really now the you know, the way the place is, and we obviously, most of us here, don't know any different. The history of our Chelmsford and Cambridge campuses go back a long way in individual institutions. They came together, I think, in the very early 90s to form Anglia Polytechnic University, which then became Anglia Ruskin University. And we now are a single, you know, post 92 organisation. The campus in Peterborough is also part of AIU. It's legally a separate entity, but the business model is basically the same. And that is that, you know, we have courses that suit local needs. We obviously have common courses, things like nursing, which are, you know, driven by the Nursing and Midwifery Council. And then we support all of our courses and all of our three campuses from a common shared services model. So we have professional services staff predominantly in numbers terms in Chelmsford. We have a smaller cadre of staff in Cambridge, and a smaller number still, because Peterborough is the smallest campus at the moment, up in Peterborough. And that's because, you know, a lot of things are driven by, like, IT, a lot is driven by helplines, facilities management, that sort of stuff. But we do provide, you know, those sort of, if you like, those customer facing professional services are provided on site. So things like library services, obviously, things like student counselling and what have you are provided on site. And then, as I say, a lot of the back office sits in Chelmsford. And as Peterborough grows, obviously it will develop its own critical mass and its own momentum, and we will add in professional services staff in line with the business plan.
And from the student experience perspective, presumably they're based on one site. They don't do a lot of moving around.
No, that's right. The only there's very little student movement, particularly at the undergraduate level. At the postgraduate level, there's more movement, and that we have a single student union, so they obviously have to do a bit of moving between the three sites. But for the great majority of undergraduates, yes, their courses are on one site only.
Yeah. So Peterborough, then. I mean, it's brand spanking new, isn't it? I mean, what? So how did that all come about? Because Peterborough has always been one of those cold spots, isn't it? That hasn't had proper HE provision for a very long time. It's always kind of top of the list of places that people. So you know, how did you end up being the ones that were providing that centre there?
Yeah, sure. So by strange coincidence, I've sort of had a relationship with Peterborough through local government for probably about 15 years now. And they have always wanted a university in Peterborough. And exactly as you say, it's an HE cold spot, which in part, prevents at the moment or limits Peterborough's ability to maximise its full potential, because it's a fantastic geographic location. It's got fantastic road networks, one of the best rail connections to London anywhere in the country. So there's huge potential there in Peterborough. And the opportunity came along not long after I arrived, actually. So I arrived in October 2018. There was discussions going on at the Cambridgeshire and Peterborough Combined Authority and with the City Council about making a university come about. And they actually started the procurement process in December 2019. So I've been lucky enough to be the SRO for that project throughout. And we've seen it grow from a very small team within ARU, basically the Vice Chancellor, myself, one or two others, with huge contributions from across the university to, recruiting the staff. We've got about 60 academic staff now. They've got their own academic offer. We've got a principal, Ross, who is doing a fantastic job up there, and a range of, other things as well. And that building is now ours. It was handed over a couple of weeks ago, and it's due to open to students in the middle of September in the normal way. It really does show, three agencies working together really, really hard to deliver that sort of common shared objective. And it's been a delight to be part of it. Absolutely fantastic opportunity.
Oh, I think it's a terrific achievement. So what in terms of the ambition then for Peterborough, how big do you expect it to get?
Well, we've got the first building opening up, as I say, in September. There's an R&D building due to open in December, and then there is a third building, a second academic building due to open, or we're just sort of going through the motions to appoint a contractor for that at the moment, so it's due to open in September 24. So they're the current three phases. There's a second R&D phase, i.e. phase four, that's being planned out and developed at the moment. And in time, the intention is to have a very vibrant university campus there in Peterborough. Looking to the longer term, there's huge potential for Peterborough. If we take the 50-year view, you start sort of having aspirations of things like a Warwick or a Loughborough, that kind of thing. Yeah. But in the short term, it's just looking towards developing the educational offer.
Yeah, and it'll stay very much part of ARU, even if it grows, I assume.
Yeah, so what we've set up is legally a separate company, but it is part of ARU. It's a time limited contract for the academic partner, and as we go through that, there is a roadmap of milestones that the university has to hit to satisfy the Combined Authority and the City Council, who are our two principal stakeholders. And then in 10 years' time, at the end of the initial academic period, the powers that be, both at ARU and at the two councils, will take a view as to whether they want it to be a standalone university or carry on with ARU at that point.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's a terrific development. So incredibly well done to you for getting it off the ground. And I do hope it succeeds as it surely should. We touched a little bit on student and student recruitment there. And at the point that we're talking, it's a kind of It's that week in the university cycle where we go through confirmation and clearing, which is obviously a, you know, a big issue for universities across the land, and even bigger issue for prospective students as well. But I mean, I wondered what your thoughts were on this year's round, because it's interesting the way it feels very different in terms of the kind of media narrative than there has been before. There's, you know, the talk of universities, you know, freezing out home students in favour of international students, and you know the usual stuff from people who never went to university saying, oh, you don't need to bother, you know, you'll get a good job anyway, it's a waste of time, Mickey Mouse degrees, etc. I mean, it feels like there's an awful lot of stuff being levelled at universities, which is not what people who are, you know, wanting to achieve and choose their courses and choose their universities, having been through the most difficult time in terms of their GCSEs and A-levels or other qualifications in the past couple of years during COVID, want to hear. And there seems to be a real danger that it kind of diminishes the achievement of those who do get into higher education. I mean, what's your thinking about it from your perspective, James?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the key point, isn't it? That the young folk that are applying to university and going through clearing at the moment, they are a generation that we've never seen the like of before, and hopefully we won't see the like of again. And they've faced enormous challenges, and particularly in their sixth form life, they've not had those sort of indirect opportunities to become independent in the way that, you know, students before and hopefully students after will have. And therefore, I think, you know, our offer as universities is not just about the education. It is about the whole student experience, the learning support, the well-being, all the rest of it. And I think that has to be the narrative. I think there's something there about, you know, for all the different analyses and ways that the data is cut, and we do a lot of that in HE, there has to be something here about being kind as well, because, you know, these young folk are setting out in life, and we need to do, and I know, you know, every university is, but I know we need to do the best that we can for them to get them through clearing, to help them through clearing, to provide them with that supportive advice, and then to make them feel welcome and comfortable when they actually arrive at university. I mean, it's interesting, just a little story, Paul. We have open days, I'm sure, as every university does. And one of the sessions we do is about the learning support for students in its various forms. Mm-hmm. And that's usually very well attended by parents. And it was noticeable this year that, A, when we put it on, the lecture theatre was absolutely packed out. Every single parent in there was obviously concerned about their loved ones and how they would be getting on at university. And the questions were really, really insightful. There was a lot of stuff about well-being and mental health and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, for me, that was a real, a really significant moment about the importance of really making our young people feel welcome when they join us.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think the other element to it, which you alluded to there, is actually sustaining them through that journey beyond arrival. Because, as you say, you know, they haven't had the experiences of independent learning during their sixth form. And they are going to need more and different kinds of support to enable them to get the most from their university experience in a way that previous generations haven't, you know, needed a much lighter hand on the tiller. And I think we all owe them, you know, the obligation to look after them as best we can to enable them to do the best work that they can while they're with us. But it's going to be hard for at least 3 or 4 years, I think, this cohort.
It's going to work through. As for the other points about international, I mean, we're not seeing that. You know, I think it's easy again to bang that sort of indirectly that populist drum, isn't it, that has been successful for some politicians. But you know, we can't get away from the fact that international students are important revenue streams to our universities. They add diversity and variety and different perspectives to what we do. They generate new subjects, new research, in a way that, you know, you could not do from just an entirely UK based population. So, you know, I don't see any of this, you know, dominance of international students that is being talked about. I just see a great richness and variety that will add to, you know, ultimately to UK PLC.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Thinking then about the future, I mean, we've got, you know, this is a very uncertain political and economic time in the UK. In terms of, you know, the institution, what do you see as the kind of big big anxieties ahead in terms of the higher education environment, because obviously we've got things like the free speech bill going through Parliament, we've got changes in the regulatory environment around the OFS and the Quality Assurance Agency, all of these issues are playing out that we just talked about in relation to particularly to visas and international recruitment, and the challenges of Russia and Ukraine, and ongoing issues around Brexit and all the rest. So what are the things that you and your executive colleagues see as the kind of biggest icebergs heading towards us that you're fretting about, that you want to talk about? You might not.
Yeah, sure. I think it is the policy environment. I mean, as somebody coming from a different sector, I'm not, as a general point, I'm pretty relaxed about what the OFS are doing. It's very, very similar to the kinds of things that went on in local government with the CQC and Ofsted and various other inspectorates. So I'm as a general point, I'm pretty relaxed about that kind of thing. But as a specific point, I mean, what we do see is quite a lot of what appears to be some quite populist policy making. And I think that's always the risk, isn't it, that we suddenly get into really good ideas quotes where you need to hit a certain tariff to get a good degree, or the phrase Mickey Mouse degrees is bandied around, or that kind of stuff, which is really, really not helpful. It's soul destroying to the students, and actually it misses the point about that some of those degrees that actually they're feeding sectors within the UK economy that are growing and really, really important. And some of the other subjects are not so important to the economy. They're great for education and for growth and all the rest of it, but they're not necessarily feeding the economy. So therefore, the potentially knee-jerk nature of some of the policies that we see coming through is quite important. And some of the freedom, some of the freedom of speech stuff is worrying as well. It's always going to be tricky. It's always going to be a tricky call. But actually just limiting free speech because it might be unpopular or challenging is not really where we need to be.
And then thinking about the kind of strategic development of your institution, my confession here, James, is in a previous role I worked at the University of East Anglia, and this is going back to the mid 90s now. One of my roles there was to explicitly to challenge the dominance of what was then Anglia Polytechnic University, I think, in the East Anglia. And the university at UEA at that time was keen to build relationships with further education colleges, because it saw itself as being completely, cut off by what Anglia was doing. It was good in that it was the university realizing it needed to do a lot more in terms of partnership. In another sense, it was bad in it was probably not terribly healthy competition between two institutions. But one of the things that strikes me about the situation that we as a whole are in now is that despite the, all the stuff in the Higher Education Research Act 2017 and all the pressures on us to be competitive, actually we still do work pretty well together as a sector. Yes, we compete in certain areas, with the student recruitment and research grants or whatever it might be. But actually, on the whole, we do play pretty nicely together. Well, and is that different from your previous experiences again in the civil service and local government, or does this feel entirely natural to you?
I think on student recruitment, I think, that is a competitive area, particularly, at times like clearing. But overall, our relationships with other universities in East Anglia are absolutely fantastic. I mean, obviously in Cambridge, we've got one of the world's leading universities and we work really, really well together. And indeed, during the pandemic, with our students living cheek by jowl, the cooperation was first rate, and it was, really, 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 really good. I think in terms of the difference from local government, it is more competitive, but there again, in that sense, local government is very, very different, because local government is the monopoly supplier in any given place. So the competition that goes on is primarily personality driven, shall we say, whereas the competition that goes on between universities is you know, is a straight market competition, isn't it? But I, you know, despite, you know, the competition that goes on in the run up to and immediately after A-level results day, collaboration within the sector, certainly in my experience, is fantastic, far, far better than I've experienced in other parts of the public sector that I worked in.
And do we learn, do you think, enough from... I mean, because there's always a tendency, again, to either look inwards, right, and ignore what everyone else is doing, or simply to look at, you know, what we might regard as peer institutions, rather than looking outside the sector at how, you know, for example, you know, the progressive ways that other parts of public services have tackled particular service delivery issues or whatever. I mean, you know, you must have a view on that, because I always worry we are too insular in that regard.
Yeah, I think we need. So I think I can, you know, I can see where you're coming from on that one, Paul. But I think we need to be careful what we wish for. Because, you know, local government has transformed dramatically, and some of the stuff it does is quite extraordinary. But it's done that off a 60% funding cut. So, you know, actually, if, you know, you could sometimes say that HE is sometimes a bit insular. That's certainly an argument I've heard. And similarly, you know, I think you could say that sometimes HE is a bit slow to change. But on the other hand, if you measure it in other ways, you know, we're seeing growth in student numbers. We're seeing, despite the pandemic, good levels of student satisfaction. We're able to demonstrate value for money across the board. We're all able to demonstrate how well we respond to student feedback and develop our courses. And certainly for, you know, for our university, we can demonstrate extraordinary success in terms of the outcomes, given our widening participation agenda. So, and we do, you know, and behind all of that, we do a lot of benchmarking, as I'm sure, you know, colleagues around the sector do. So I think, you know, in terms of transformation and how much do we change, I think it's very much about which prism you're looking through. And if you look through some of the traditional prisms, you might get an answer that, yeah, we're a little bit slow. But hang on, if you look at it another way around, we're doing some quite extraordinary things for our staff and for our students.
Yeah, no, I get that. That's really insightful. No, thank you. And then my concluding question or observation, Jack. So, you know, you've been in the sector for 4 years. You've been actively involved in AHUA, the Association of Heads of University Administration. I mean, what's your, without wishing to invite you to kick the august body that is AHUA, what's your thinking about that as a kind of vehicle for, I mean, particularly for someone coming in from outside the sector? Have you found it a kind of useful way to connect with colleagues?
Yes, I have. And, you know, the things I like about AHUA is that we run elections. We're obviously a trusted source with central government, and Catherine and colleagues do a fantastic job there in linking up with bits of central government. And I think, you know, the development offer we have for individuals, whether it's, you know, aspirant COO/registrar courses or coaching or mentoring, or indeed the conferences, which are a good developmental opportunity themselves, I think are really, really good. I think, you know, participation levels, when I look across the association, are really, really good as well. And similarly, so is sort of swapping of notes and sharing. I used to be in a similar role in my previous sector, and again, you know, that the society I was involved in had many, many strengths. But in terms of sharing and in terms of developing understanding and in terms of coaching and developing, you know, the next generation of senior leaders, I think AHUA does, you know, a very, very good job.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. But I'm glad you said that. Well, listen, James, we need to stop there. I just want to say thank you so much for the conversation. It's been really interesting, really insightful, and great to hear about Anglia Ruskin, but also particularly the developments in Peterborough too, and indeed your history in other parts of public services. So thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thanks very much, Paul.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with university registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.